I'm sure many of you are familiar with the recent publication of Dr. Mattson, B.H. Roberts' Defender of the Faith, which documents many of B.H.'s struggles, contributions, and so forth. Dr. Mattson, of course, is a professor of philosophy at BYU. His accomplishments and positions are very distinguished, and we very much welcome him. We will now turn the lectern over to Dr. Mattson for his presentation, following which we will introduce our other two respondents.
Thank you. As I drove up tonight and saw the incredible number of cars, I thought perhaps the zoo had been closed. But now that I've studied your faces, no, I'm very honored, more than fact than I can say, that this somewhat inaugural address having to do with the new society in the name of B.H. Roberts has fallen to me, and equally grateful that I see so many here who know aspects of this man better than I. Let me indulge just two personal beginnings. I want you to know that when Sterling Van Wagenen invited me to this, and when I asked him, after saying yes, why me, he said, well, you've worked with his thought. And then something was said about, and you've also written about his life. And then Sterling said something like this. I won't dodge for the words, but he said, well, anyone can deal with a life, but few can really deal with ideas. As I've thought about that, I realize that I seriously doubt that you can separate the life of a man from the thought of a man. And that Roberts himself both taught and illustrated the point that when you do attempt that separation, you do so at great hazard. You distort and you falsify. To put it positively, this man experienced much of what he thought. And there is a distinction between that and the kind of thinking which consists simply in reading and then repeating profound remarks which one partially understands. The other personal comment has to do with Robert's own approach to the articles of faith. He, of course, was familiar with the historical genesis of the so-called Wentworth letter and the attempt of Joseph Smith to place in a concise form some of the salient beliefs of the church. But he thought it unfortunate that we quickly harden on those to the point, first of all, of not recognizing that there is much more to be said, and secondly, falling too easily into the notion that Mormonism is a tradition which has already been finalized and which now only remains to be analyzed. That, of course, went against his understanding of an expanding empirical theology which is subject to both enlightenment from above and the best efforts, as it were, from below. So on an occasion when he was, I think, within the middle 60s, Roberts was himself asked, what impresses you most about Mormonism? This was in 1924. Let me just quickly read, and I don't know how long it took him to strike these off, his basic answer. Number one, it's views of God. Second, it's views of man. Third, it's views of creation. Four, it's view of the universe. Five, it's view of the purpose of life. Six, it's view of the atonement of Christ. Seven, it's view of the gospel as a means of man's salvation. Eight, the grandeur and consistency of its development as the dispensation of the fullness of times, the completion of the plans of God with reference to the redemption of the earth and the salvation of man. And finally, its views of the physical resurrection and the future degrees of glory to which man will be assigned as the outcome of his earth life. Excellent and articulate, therefore, though the articles of faith may be, and implicit may be in much that he says here, notice how he begins and ends his own sense of meaning. I turn then to really three main points. I want for a time to talk first about his insistence on the individual as responsible, which is part of our title. Then second, I want to deal for a time with his understanding of certain words in the 13th article of faith. And I suggest to you he got beyond the surface. And some of you may have a fresh insight from those. And then third, some comment on how he related and interrelated these insights and how they, in fact, came out in his own life. To begin with, then, the individual for B.H. Roberts has no beginning. His insight on this point, which is implicit in almost everything he wrote from his mature years on, derived mainly from two sources: from the careful reading of section 93 of the Doctrine and Covenants, and from the King Follett Discourse. It is, as most of you know, the classical tradition in the West to hold that existence as we know it, that is, space-time existence and things within that matrix, are all of them the product of one fiat act, namely God's ex nihilo creation, and that therefore nothing that now exists in addition to God would exist were it not for the act of God. That assumption is at work in much traditional and contemporary theology. And Roberts, in the name of Mormonism, rejects it. The exact language, you may recall, in the King Follett Discourse is approximately this: you ask learned divines, who made God? And they reply, no one. God is self-existent. Then says Joseph Smith, the idea is correct enough, but how did it get in your head? How do you know that man does not exist on the same principles? And then answering his own rhetorical question, he says, man does exist on the same principles. The Section 93 version simply says, and I am leaving out the word truth, which is heavy, and simply using the word intelligence. Intelligence is independent in that sphere in which God has placed it. Notice it doesn't say in the realm which God created. As also it elsewhere says is truth. And then it says, behold, here is the agency of man. And here is the condemnation of men. It goes on to say that every man's spirit that receiveth not the light is under condemnation. For that which was from the beginning, and Roberts points out, I think correctly, that beginning is always a local word in Mormon scriptures. It means one or another in a series. That which was from the beginning is plainly manifest unto them, and they receive not the light. His way of responding, by the way, to that phrase was that man's inherent spirit, or if you will, intelligence, and they are not exactly synonyms, are native to truth. Now, for him, it was important to insist that this primal intelligence, this uncreate something that is you, your very identity, is an individual. It does not specifically say so in section 93. One has to put an S. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say intelligences are. It says intelligence is. And that leaves some room for question. But as Roberts understood the entire discourse and other things in our scriptures, it seemed to him inevitable. The intelligence is an ego, a self. And its freedom, it follows, is itself uncreate. For B.H. Roberts, it is simply impossible for God to create freedom. God himself, being self-existent, is free, so are all other intelligent beings. And it is impossible, finally, therefore, for even God to force anyone to believe anything. That's how free we are. One can, should he so choose, resist God and resist self-existent and eternal law forever. Incredible, one might say, that a decision could be made of such vast consequences and for such a lengthy time. But that is precisely how powerful our freedom is. It follows from this that the one thing P.H. Roberts wouldn't permit anyone to say, but notice, since he believed in freedom, his failing to permit didn't always result in what he wished. The one thing he would not permit himself to say, and which he discouraged in others, was, I am a victim. No one, on his view, can truly say, I am a victim. If you'll permit a, I hope not, blasphemous aside, I occasionally hear in sociological discussions the statement that there are no, after all, delinquent children. There are only delinquent parents. And of course, one can push that chain. We, in the theological realm, often push it to the point of blaming another intelligence, namely
the devil. And of course, the explanation he can give is that he had delinquent parents. It is, put a different way, when the child comes home from school and hands you a report card and says, which do you think it is, Dad, heredity or environment? There is a third alternative. It is you. And in the end, for Roberts and for Mormonism, that's where we all are. We not only choose between courses of action, we choose in the very making of ourselves and have no one else ultimately to blame. Billiard balls and stones react, but with freedom, human beings respond. And they have always a measure of control in how they respond, no matter what happens to them. That's freedom. Notice in passing that Brother Roberts and the Mormon heritage are not troubled, as most Western philosophers are, with the idea of an infinite regress. It is crucial to the argument, for example, of Thomas Aquinas for the nature of God to say, we have things, but things aren't their own explanation. They must have been caused, and then whatever caused them must itself have been caused, and so on. But, in Aristotelian fashion, he goes on, you must stop that regress somewhere. There had to be a first cause. And this, he concludes, is what men call God. When Joseph Smith was asked, did God have a prior God? His answer was yes. And when someone said, and what about him? Yes. Well, where do you stop it? The answer is nowhere. There is an infinite series, backward and forward. That is indeed mind-boggling. But I don't think any more mind-boggling than holding that you have to stop with a marvelous, uncaused cause named God. For that is, as a professor once said to me, to swallow the elephant and then gag at the tail. So, we have insisted here as a beginning that this man taught individuality and responsibility as uncreate. Now, I'm tempted to draw out some of the implications he drew out, but let me just mention one. Much discussion goes on at every level of our lives about the nature of faith. Is it circular? Is it blind? Is it bootstrapped? Is it self-deception? Is it projection? Roberts, with the premise we've been discussing, once said, faith is fidelity to truth learned, parenthesis, by mind, parenthesis, ages ago. Most discussions of faith presume that we begin the foundations of experience and commitment here. But the notion of an eternal, uncreated ego and a premortal condition makes it clear we bring an immense amount into the world. But, says someone, how can that have any effect since we also teach that there is a total forgetting? Good question. Most social scientists, I think, today agree that the most important period of your early life, your infancy, first 2.5 to 3 years, that all that follows in your life will be directly related to your initial experiences at that age. And yet most of us can't remember anything about those first years. Try Clearly, then, we have an analog here for the reactions of our own experience to recognize that forgetting does not necessarily change the impact of experience, which is down deep and recorded somewhere. He pushed that all the way into the former world and even beyond that, and concluded that much of our predisposition, if you will, and he would go further and say our very character here, reflects what went on before. I have a quotation in the book where he uses kinder words than he used for himself. He occasionally thought of himself as having vicious parentage. He wasn't speaking of his immediate parents, but of some of his forebears. And tragic environmental factors. Yet he insisted, I think himself in mind, as well as some others he knew, that a noble spirit can rise up and resist both and become a benefactor to mankind. Let me then turn next to his reading of the 13th article of faith, which his first observation, I think, would be, is 13th. What's the point of saying that? Well, one is that apparently Joseph Smith didn't have any numerological superstitions. But number two, it does come after some other things. And here again we see in this man an insistence that things interrelate, that context is always crucial to text. And one of the things that appealed to him about Mormonism was that it is coherent. Oh yes, there are tensions and there are fragmentations and there are difficulties, but it is, for B.H. Roberts and I think for authentic Mormonism, a sign of something wrong instead of something right when you find a paradox. Well, that won't come as a surprise, perhaps won't even come as worth saying to some of you, but you must understand that in the real world of theology, as well as certain forms of contemporary philosophy, paradox is a high recommendation. I can illustrate quickly with a story. I had a professor a time ago who made a fairly elementary point in class, namely, either there is or there is not a God. The student present, who, by the way, had been trained under Karl Barth and Emil Brunner, for whom paradox is a clue to truth, was upset and said that those are not the only alternatives. You're falling into a logical straitjacket. The professor was puzzled and said, well, what is the third alternative? He said, well, there are three. One, there is a God. Two, there is no God. Three, there both is and is not a God. I laughed, as you did. He took me aside afterward. I think I probably laughed louder than anyone. Why did you laugh? He said. And I wasn't very thoughtful. I said, I suppose because I thought it was funny. And then he gave me a real sermon. That's just the trouble with people like you. You try to pull things down to your own level. You insist that you have to fit things in logic. Life and the truth about God has nothing to do with logic. Well, the creeds are full of such paradoxes. And when you say to people who urge them, but that is a contradiction, their answer is always with a smile, of course. And where do you go from there? B.H. Roberts felt about that, I just have to put it to you candidly, the way he felt about other things, it was nonsense. And solemn nonsense at that. Well, what do you do then with the real contradictions that seem to appear here and there in your own religion, people said to Roberts. He said, I'm working on them. I'm trying to resolve them. I'm trying to show that they may arise from semantic clumsiness or from something else. Does religion have to be logical? His answer was, yes. Is there more than logic to life? Of course. But back to the point. We are talking about an article that follows other articles and that relates to them, which would help then deal with what otherwise is very puzzling. For example, the simple statement in the 13th article of faith, we believe all things. Do we? All what things? Well, it's a paraphrase of Paul, and Paul obviously was speaking in context, and so is Brother Roberts. We believe all these things that have been stated before and the implications thereof. But for him it was important to insist on the all too. It isn't sufficient to say that we believe some of these or those that are most favorable to our own wishes. He was a kind of all or nothing personality. He viewed the basic doctrines and principles as including each other and not up for fragmentation. He lamented always that one can only teach in fragments and by doing so mislead. He hoped to, and never succeeded, to preach one comprehensive sermon in his life that covered it all. He was aware of his very interesting statement of Joseph Smith that it is not wisdom to have all knowledge presented to us at once, supposing that were possible, because we couldn't understand it, but a little at a time. Well, he grew in that recognition. But the article of faith has been cited, I think, here and recommended for discussion because it is an inclusive kind of statement. It trying to sum up a little and then open up not just to the basic theological or the philosophical presuppositions of the theological position, but to anything that is lovely, praiseworthy, virtuous, or of good report. Well, he took that seriously. And he just had an omnivorous appetite for truth, for reading, for experience. I use a stronger word. It was carnivorous. He went for strong meat. And he was as concerned to learn from the opposition, should have put an S on that, as he was to learn from the pristine, more or less clear truth. Of course, this man loved, pondered, prayed over the scriptures. But he also read everything he could get his hands on in anti-Mormon literature. Loved it. And loved to wrestle with all the alternatives. And often said that truth is understood, sometimes at least, best when it is in contrast to something else. I think he would have agreed wholeheartedly with a famous essay of John Stuart Mill. The truth only lives and moves when it is in the presence of difficulties and opposition. He took very seriously the Book of Mormon statement, there must needs be opposition in all things. I'm not sure in our generation we could follow him in some of the applications he made of that idea. Let me give you three examples. I was a mission president in the eastern states. He was in Brooklyn, of course, and that wasn't too far by subway from Times Square. And Times Square was attractive to Roberts, not because of the Broadway plays, but because there were endless numbers of public speakers around. talking, advocating, arguing, debating, or whatever. He sometimes put off his decent suit and put on a fairly desultory one and went away from the mission home on a Saturday afternoon and went down and took him on. Not necessarily with respect to Mormonism. Sometimes didn't even admit he was a Mormon. Any subject that he thought he could get somebody going on to sharpen his wits. There are specific counsels, I happen to know, to mission presidents generally, to avoid vain confrontations and disputes. And of course the reason for that is that they are profitless, futile, and in fact sometimes set us back instead of forward. But suppose your objective isn't to represent a cause. Suppose your objective is to simply get out in the cold north wind of controversy and see how well you can do. And clarify your own mind, blow the carbon out of your vocabulary, come back refreshed. That was his objective, and he did it. He even encouraged his missionaries to do it, and that hit the fan some places. A second example is that Roberts, I think, felt more strongly about defining experience in an inclusive way than some of us would. He believed that there is ultimately no way to teach us what we need to learn except by first-hand experience. Now, happily, that can break into two categories. One is less painful than the other, supposedly. Vicarious and actual. One can identify in imagination and in empathic response with another and learn much. And by the way, one of the most pleasing comments I've had about the book has come from those who've said, well, this man is both a bad example and a good example. I've tried to tell some of his own struggles and difficulties, some of his giant frailties, which he had. One can learn what not to do from Roberts as well as what to do. But he felt very strongly, and psychologists, I suppose, would say this was merely autobiographical. He was trying to justify the rather checkered life he lived. I think that's superficial. He was convinced, I'll start the sentence afresh, that there is only one way to learn, and that's by experience, and that means of the bitter as it means of the sweet. And I think ultimately he would insist, even now, that it is impossible to be perfected without exposure to raw contrast. He went even further. It is clear from many of the things he wrote pertaining to his understanding of the future that, well, this will come as a shock to some, we will never be completely free of stress. Sorry. There isn't available a way to avoid experience in contrast and regret. And to say that we will one day be in a condition where we will have pure bliss is sweet theology, but false. We are in a universe where there is only growth when there is experience, and only experience when there is contrast. And yes, we learn and step forward, but we step forward then to new levels of new problems which are difficult. And who would want to opt for that as the pattern we should seek? More of the same forever? Only the Mormons. A third example. The man often tried to learn, not just by the alternative, but by the opposite position. He says somewhere that there's never been an error, at least not an error that really appealed to people and lasted in its appeal, that didn't have somewhere a sparkle of truth. There is, to put it differently, no independent set of principles which have been invented and put forward by, if you will, the forces of the demonic. They are usurpers and counterfeiters of what is true. And one can learn by knowing, therefore, the most strained and strange extremes in the world. Notice that that is, on the one hand, a rejection. How can the opposite of the truth be worth anything? It's also the recognition there's something that gives it its appeal. Now, he was not a Hegel who thought there would be a synthesis of the opposites. But he was one who saw scattered and broken lights everywhere. Well, now to what I would like to say about his drawing out some of these ideas, revolving around those four words: virtuous, lovely, praiseworthy, and of good report. B.H. Roberts was preoccupied with studying and getting his people to study, not just the great and major Christian faiths and Judaic faiths, but world religions. In the book, I indicate a whole series of articles that he invited from the representatives of the major faiths, including one on agnosticism, but that doesn't say it all. He had, in the same general period, other representatives of Buddhism, Hinduism, Confucianism, and one can name others, and presented them in the church's own magazine. Why? Well, there are many things one could quote from him, but let me quote the verse, as it were, which is at the root of his quotations. It's from Joseph Smith. We, speaking of the Mormons, must gather all the good and true principles in the world. That doesn't even limit it to the religious world, notice. All the good and true principles in the world, and treasure them up, or we shall not come out true Mormons. So he wanted to live another 50 years to study more in the world religions and beyond. Roberts could never quite join enthusiastically those within or beyond the church who wanted to castigate science, per se, its methods, its conclusions, its assumptions. He rather wanted to reconcile. He wanted to collaborate, and he thought he had an obligation to relate what the latest best guess of the scientists is with respect to the nature of the universe. Now, I smiled and you think I was being demeaning. I said, yes. Isn't that too humble a word to use for science? He would say, no, it's not too humble a word. Science is doing its best, and in a process which involves self-correction, to cope with the phenomena of the natural order. Science is probabilistic. Science rarely comes down hard with a certainty. Certitude, maybe, but that means there's there's room for a little change. Or, as Dewey once said, until further notice. He liked that, but he also felt, as I repeat, an obligation to relate our perspective religiously to the latest and best scientific thought. Now, some felt that was pointless, and he himself, of course, had regrets that some of his efforts were not all that intelligent or coherent. He didn't feel really expert, and yet, with a tremendous amount of boldness and intellectual courage, he dove in. I believe we can profit from that example. And then third, I'd like to say this about the lovely aspect of the article. No one comes to complete agreement with anyone else, I notice, on what is and is not beautiful. You know the story. This is just for a little comic relief about the woman who went to the Metropolitan Museum, took 5 minutes, threw all of it that quickly, and harumphed at each picture, and then one last harumph as she walked out. The guard stopped her and said, "Madam, the paintings are not on trial. You are." That would be called aesthetic objectivism. That's the position, that beauty is not in the eye of the beholder. Beauty is there. And those who have eyes to see recognize it, and the perverse and the blind do not, and that is that. Well, you can get an argument any time. Vincent Price tells of the woman who said in the same museum once, "That is the ugliest, the most gross, the most pitiful thing I've ever seen. What is it?" And he replied, "That, madam, is a mirror." Roberts would side with those who hold that beauty is more than the beholder and the eye. And he loved beauty, he once said in a journal entry, almost to the point of worship. And later on, he removed the almost. The beauty of the universe, and even of our world, when it hasn't been radically polluted, often overwhelming. And he had a similar passion on the other side, namely a retreat and a recoiling from the ugly. And that's one place where his literary inclusiveness stopped. He could not read what he called the sewer air of modern fiction. And if it was that in his day, how do you think he'd feel about contemporary fiction? Now, as for the expression virtuous and praiseworthy, the word virtue has almost gone out of our vocabulary. The word noble, likewise. The word duty, even. Much talk of rights. Very little duty. But he viewed the virtuous life as the life in harmony with God. And there was the word he substituted for what most theologians love to work with when they talk about the absolute. I repeat, Roberts insisted on the pluralism of selves as well as in the cosmos. And for that reason, was most suspicious of ultimate abstraction. Nothing bored him more, I can say this having read it, than the word with a capital B, being. Oh, that's an impressive word. In the Western world, it didn't affect him at all. Being, totally empty for us. Now, if you add an S, he begins to get interested. All right, with that premise, he moves to the view that harmony of the soul, which is itself made up of at least three major facets, intelligence, spirit, and body. Harmony of those three is really holiness as it is wholeness. But then harmony of such a self with other like harmonized selves is the church, or ought to be. And the ultimate harmonization of such wills, all of them voluntarily agreeing to that unity, is the very nature of God. But even God is God's three persons, and not in one substance. Three persons whose unity consists in the harmony of their consciousness, their will, and their purposes. And in the ultimate condition of soul, which the scriptures call the glorified life, or the fullness which all of us may legitimately aspire to. Now, I want to just say two more things and open to the commentators. It's not unusual to see Roberts repeating himself over the years, and part of that arises not simply from the fact that repetition is the mother of learning, but that there are some things we are wont to forget quickly. It is easy to slip, partly under the influence of the fallout of competing ideas. And so he constantly taught that one must return to bedrock principles frequently, frequently return to one's basic understandings, and then move out anew. And that the failure to do that is dangerous. I see in that both his adventurousness, because he was always, as it were, on the frontier, struggling in his own limited way with what he understood, and trying to widen its application. But at the same time, it's the recognition that in the midst of all this becoming, there is something that abides. There is something that is permanent. And so even in the midst of a sermon on the importance of living oracles to give living interpretation to living problems, he balances with some statements on the cruciality of what has already been written and given, how these are to be meshed. Now, there's a tension, constant tension. But for him, that was what gave this movement life. Abiding truth, but increased, was very to living problems. He balances with some statements on the cruciality of what has already been written and given, how these are to be meshed. Now, there's a tension, constant tension. But for him, that was what gave this movement life. Abiding truth, but increasing expansion of truth likewise. Secondly, he was very impressed with the last word, or close to the last. We seek after these things. And I suppose the most frequent question he raised among the saints was, do we? Do we really? Oh, it's easy to say. We're for every good thing. But for him, the truth is a gem that loves the deep. And those who don't care much do not find. Something like 72 recurrent phrases in the Doctrine and Covenants say, basically, seek and ye shall find.
For him, the negative implication is don't seek in a whole-souled way, and you will not find. It is not simply an easy, superficial matter to get hold of the fundamental powers in the Mormon heritage. It is difficult. He loved the statement of Joseph Smith, balancing the three words that are important. When out of the Liberty jail, he wrote that fanciful and flowery and heated imagination or inquiry is vain. But on the other side, careful and ponderous and solemn thoughts can only find them out. And the them refers back to the things of God. It follows that for him, one can never justifiably say, I've got it, and now I don't worry about learning anymore. For him, this is the beginning of the quest which will continue, which began before we came and continues and will extend far into the future. That was for him a zestful realization. For some people, it's very discouraging. And I can understand. It's frustrating even that we are merely getting a beginning and that life passes us so quickly. But, I repeat, for him, there are depths beyond depths beyond depths. And that leads to my final footnote comment. The articles of faith, of course, are faith-related, and the central personality is Christ. B.H. Roberts once observed that a university is really not a collection of buildings, a massing of books, a set of laboratories. He said, a university, if you really get down to cases, is a set of personalities. And exclusively, those personalities define the institution. We are so impressed at times with the power of organization, or what some of the computer buffs call the hardware. Computerized indifference, somebody calls it. That we don't understand that. It is the personality of the teacher and the student that makes all the difference. When occasionally people came to Roberts and said, my son or my daughter is out, meaning either out of the church or out of harmony, he would say he has yet to meet a great interpreter. He had one, and there isn't time for me to dwell. Maybe more than one. But ultimately, the power of this system is embodied in a person, and that for him was Christ. And so for him, one only learns the deepest when he attempts to relate to personalities. If he seeks to learn on a mere abstract level without that relationship, he can get some kinds of enlightenment, but not the life-changing and transforming kind. So of all things virtuous, praiseworthy, lovely, and of good report to seek the beginning and the end for B.H. Roberts was Christ. Thank you.
responding tonight to Dr. Madsen are Davis Bitton and Ann Osborne. Dr. Bitton is a professor of history at the University of Utah, a former president of the Mormon History Association, and author of a number of articles and books, among the most prominent of which is The Mormon Experience. We will hear from him, and following him, Dr. Ann Osborne, associate professor of radiology at the University of Utah and an instructor in the Church Institute system.
It's good to see this turnout tonight, this great expression of interest in B.H. Roberts and what he stood for. Brother Madsen, who is a great interpreter, as he used the expression. I couldn't very well respond to Brother Madsen directly, since I've only heard it just when you heard it. But perhaps the word response can be used a little more flexibly, because I was asked to address a few comments to the subject of the 13th Article of Faith. Our openness to truth from all sources. This is rather a tall order for me because I have a cluttered mind and I see problems where other people see wonderful simplicities. But I won't try to elaborate on some of these problems for which I think most of which there must be answers. But in my allotted few minutes, to offer a few remarks you might find worth considering. As a child, did the rest of you learn the 13th Article of Faith, along with the Articles of Faith, the memorization process that we went through in the primary association? I did that, and whatever age that is, and even then, I liked it very well. It was one of my very favorite Articles of Faith. I'm not sure I understood it. I'm not sure I understand it fully now. What does it mean, for example, to be honest? And benevolent. Is that not a concept that should be worked into our character much more fully than it usually is? But I did gather that the 13th Article of Faith had a theme of openness, a general attitude of receptivity to anything good and true and beautiful. Not until much later did I discover that Joseph Smith or Orson Pratt or whoever helped him with the original phraseology that he then adapted derived much of this terminology directly from Paul's epistle to the Philippians, as we've heard. Finally, brethren, Paul wrote, whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are of good report, if there be any virtue and if there be any praise, think on these things. This was the same Paul who earlier in the same epistle prayed that the Philippians might, quote, approve things that are excellent. And elsewhere, as you know, he urged his readers to prove all things, meaning test all things, and hold fast to that which is good. This openness to the good, the true, and the beautiful, and all things excellent, I take to be the spirit of our 13th Article of Faith. Consistent with this basic attitude, both Joseph Smith and Brigham Young expressed the idea that Mormonism encompassed all truth. The Journal of Discourses contains at least a dozen such statements from Brigham Young. Here is just one example. Mormonism, or in other words, the gospel of salvation, embraces the whole. It incorporates every true principle there is in heaven and on earth. If a person learns a truth, he learns so much of the gospel of salvation. There are other excellent statements along the same line from President Young, George Q. Cannon, John Taylor, and many of our other leaders who obviously were not lacking in confidence. Henry Eyring Our eminent Mormon scientist, who just this week received another honor, tells this story of his departure for college. Maybe you've heard this. He was just a boy growing up on a farm in Arizona, I believe it was, and his father gave him the following words of advice. Just remember this, son. The Lord doesn't expect you to believe anything that isn't so. Dr. Eiling has said that this advice has served him very well over the years. It means, I take it, that anything untrue does not have to be accepted as part of the gospel. And perhaps implicit in this fatherly advice is the idea that anything that is true can and should be accepted as part of the gospel, Brigham Young's comprehensive definition. And Joseph Smith, as we heard just a moment ago. When I was a young student at Brigham Young University, part of my past I don't always admit, but I was there. I had the good fortune to be taught by teachers whose Christian character I could admire and who seemed to have reconciled commitment to the gospel with professional competence and a receptivity to truth and beauty on all sides. One of these teachers, a somewhat gruff but beloved character, many of you know, was Parley A. Christensen, known affectionately as P.A. As a student, I picked up some of his attitudes toward life and education. Later, he applied Matthew Arnold's terminology and the general mindset of the 13th Article of Faith to the Latter-day Saints in an essay which he entitled, We Seek After These Things, published in the Millennial Star in the early 1950s. Let me quote just a few sentences from it. As the glory of God is intelligence, so men can be saved only as they use their intelligence in gaining knowledge. To a people inspired by conceptions like these, religion is infinitely more than a legacy to be preserved. It is a marvelous destiny to be realized. It is not a look backward, but a look forward, Godward. The spirit of openness represented in the 13th Article of Faith was still alive and well in P.A. Christensen. What then is the problem? Well, we do in fact have a problem in translating lofty statements of principle into our individual and group life. It is much easier to proclaim a willingness to accept truth from all sources than it is to make this willingness manifest in specific instincts. Oh, that's proof that I need my glasses. In specific instances. There we go. The problems are manifold and require a thorough discussion of a kind impossible here tonight. Let me just toss out a question. If we are open to truth from all sources, why are we so smug? Or why do we impress others as being so smug that we have it all? There seems to be some kind of incompatibility there between that kind of projection of ourselves and the proclaimed receptivity to truth from all sources. There are things we can learn, I believe, as we think about this problem from the confrontation of religions and philosophies and cultures in many different contexts. One of the most interesting, it seems to me, is the rights controversy, as it is known, when Jesuit missionaries in the 17th and 18th centuries attempted to accommodate their message to the language and culture of the Chinese. How do you communicate with people of other cultures, indeed those of your own culture? How do you show a willingness to transpose your truths into their keys without losing the harmonies and overtones that make up the genius of the message you proclaim? Similarly, how do you take in something good and true from another setting when it doesn't fit readily into the whole, the gestalt of your own truth system? The particular place in which that little tile might be placed, however beautiful small object might be, the place is already filled. It is, after all, not really a question of sorting potatoes by throwing out the bad and keeping the good ones. We have to do with systems, cultures, whole complexes, the parts of which are interrelated. This is not the kind of challenge to be solved by uttering truisms. One of B.H. Roberts' favorite statements was the following. I think it's something that I would recommend for you to ponder. You've heard this before, I think. Unity in essentials, liberty in non-essentials, charity in all. I repeat that. Unity in essentials, liberty in non-essentials, charity in all. I like that. I liked that when I first came across it. It is in essentials that we should agree. But I've learned more about that statement over the years. As a student of the Reformation, I've learned that this particular statement in those words, actually first in Latin, originated in the 16th century in the context of Reformation controversy. Expressed the point of view of various moderates, the Erasmians, who were trying to avoid religious war and further schism by relegating some questions to the area that they called adiaphora, A-D-I-A-P-H-O-R-A, meaning things indifferent or non-essentials, on which believing Christians could safely disagree without danger to their fundamental unity. Although these heroic peacemakers in the 16th century enjoyed some small successes, sooner or later they came to grief on the rocks of an uncomfortable discovery. People cannot agree on what is essential and what is non-essential. In case you consider this as something remote from us, may I remind you that B.H. Roberts himself came to discover on more than one occasion that something he considered non-essential was not so considered by others. Looking at those specific...
And vice versa.
Vice versa, very true. And vice versa. And it can be very educational to look at those specific instances in his life. But we have enough from our own life, maybe we don't need to look back in his. And yet, can we simply throw up our hands and abandon the effort to make the distinction? Unless such a distinction is made, how are we to relate to other cultures? Are we to insist that the 24th of July parade with little covered wagons is an essential part of the gospel of Jesus Christ in Korea, in the Philippines? I think something that we might be willing to... relegate to the area of non-essentials. As we move from that on across the spectrum, there comes a point at which the differentiation becomes somewhat more difficult. But unless we're willing to make such distinctions, how can we relate to other cultures, to new truths when they appear on the horizon, indeed to our brothers and sisters within the fold, with whom we don't necessarily agree with on everything? It is not over such questions as how many candle power or kilowatts of glory are generated in the different levels of the terrestrial kingdom that we should consign one another to the depths of a primordial swamp. It is time to return to the Apostle Paul. In the same epistle to the Philippians, containing the passage that inspired the 13th article of faith, we are reminded of another set of values in counterbalance, if not in tension, with those of openness to anything excellent and praiseworthy. For Paul, let us remember, did have convictions. He preached Christ and him crucified without apology. He was not a sponge soaking up anything that happened to be in the environment. He was proclaiming the good news he had discovered and wanted the saints at Philippi and elsewhere to do the same. And he wanted them to be unified. Fulfill ye my joy, that ye be like-minded, having the same love, being of one accord, of one mind, he said. Now, it might be argued that these objectives expressed in that statement, unity within the fold and a confident proclamation to those on the outside, are inconsistent with any real generosity, tolerance, or receptiveness to the perspectives and insights of those coming from other settings. I would be the first to recognize that narrowness and self-satisfaction might be among the perils of any believing people, former day or latter day. But I am comforted to discover that Paul, at least, could urge his followers to hold fast to the truth while at the same time testing all things and approving things that are excellent. There must be some kind of salutary balance that is attainable that will enable us to be neither obnoxious dogmatists, sure that we have all the answers, nor spineless blobs of protoplasm that give in to anything, always agreeing with anything that anyone says. Paul is not a bad model. That is what we need, models. Our young people, all of us, need more leaders who exemplify breadth of interest, competence, the capacity to make the all-important distinctions, separating the wheat from the chaff, minds and spirits that do not claim to have arrived, but that instead are engaged in an eternal quest, a dynamic, never-ending process of growth and expanding horizons. We can be grateful for a founding prophet who proclaimed a willingness to accept all that God has revealed, all that he does now reveal, and all that he will yet reveal. We can be grateful for those Latter-day Saints, and there are some who even now show by their lives what it means to be humane and benevolent and growing in knowledge and appreciation. And perhaps it is not inappropriate to express special thanks for B.H. Roberts, that valiant soul who for the 70-some years of his own allotted span exemplified courage and commitment, along with a willingness to reassess, to steadily push back his own frontiers, and to incorporate into his understanding the true and beautiful wherever he found them.
Brothers and sisters, friends and neighbors, the few comments that I have to make this evening, I'd like to change pace a little bit and make them from a very personal point of view. I have a personal background that varies from many of you in that I've not been a member of the church all or even most of my life, and I can't trace pioneer ancestors back any farther than myself. And as a matter of fact, this represents a rather striking departure from our family tradition. And to give you a little idea of what that is, when my great-grandfather was, in essence, excommunicated and disfellowshipped from the family when he violated two sacred family precepts. One, he joined the Methodist Church, and two, he voted the Republican ticket. And I hate to tell you what their view of me is at this point. As I read Brother Madsen's biography of B.H. Roberts, and as I listened to him speak tonight, there were three things that came across to me very forcefully. The importance of individuality, responsibility, and inquiry. And I suppose we could put them together in saying it's our individual responsibility to inquire. And this is a very interesting departure from the background in which I was raised, the theological background. In fact, it's an interesting concept to think of theology not as a concept, but as a dynamic process. And it seems to be a dynamic process with some tension and moving together between two facets that Brother Madsen referred to, enlightenment from above and inspired thoughts or individual inquiry from below, and that what comes out of those is a dynamic, changing, growing theology. And to me, that was one of the attractive things about the church. I think, though, that any one of you in the audience who is a, any one of you in the audience who is a convert to the church, I would be willing to bet my next paycheck, I was going to say my next quarter's pay, but I won't, that you were attracted to the church not initially because of the theology, but because of what Elder Manson talked about in B.H. Roberts' life, namely that he experienced much of what he thought and believed. What we perceive about the church as outsiders is initially exactly that, the experience, the product in a life of a belief process and a theology. And to me, that's the important part about the church. It's the dynamic interaction, if you will, between believing, being, and becoming that it's all about. In terms of individual responsibility, it's interesting to think that we are not set in any given path, that in fact we don't believe in predestination and divine election, as I once thought. That if you had talked to me 15 years ago, I would have gone from I would have evolved from believing in theological predestination and divine election to somewhat more a sociological determinism, where our beliefs and actions are set by our environment, and perhaps 5 years after that, I would have believed that perhaps there was a biological determinism, that in fact we're the products of our genes with a little smattering of interaction of the environment. And finally, just this last year, I suppose, were I not a member of the church, we could even have a biochemical determinism, namely if we believe that there are certain polypeptides floating around in our brains, that much of what we say and do is the interaction of those and the product of those. I think it's, in terms of the 13th article of faith, that it's not only the finding of the good, the honest, the praiseworthy, and so on, but it's the process of seeking that's equally as important. It's both exhilarating and exalting. It's ennobling and uplifting. And when we do it together, as well as individuals, it's exciting as well. In Mormon theology, as I look at it, it's not only does the end not justify the means, but the end is in fact predicated on those very means. And that if we as individuals and collectively engage in enlightened, prayerful study and inquiry, the dynamic interaction, the growing, changing, expanding theology can only advance us together toward that common goal which we all seek. Individuality, responsibility, inquiry. I've learned those watchwords and hope that as individuals and as members of this society, that we can keep those in mind and together progress further. Thank you very much.
We'd very much like to thank our speakers tonight for the insight that they have given us. We had intended to go to 9:30 tonight. We still have a little bit to go, and I wondered if you would be interested in maybe a 10-minute question-answer period. We like to push it as far as we can go. We can't get enough. Okay, environmental conditions mandate, I suppose. This building intends to be a pretty exact replication of the social hall. There are some concessions to modernism, one of which is air conditioning and a handicap lift and a nice kitchen downstairs and some bathrooms for which we are thankful. not in any particular order. I would like to make a couple of announcements before we dismiss. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you who have come tonight. We appreciate your response, and you've been an excellent audience. We're glad that you've been able to share this experience with us. We thank our speakers for their preparation thoughtfulness and sharing their insight with us. We'd like to thank the State Parks for allowing us to use this facility tonight. We appreciate the efforts of the Sunstone Foundation staff in helping with the details, and particularly the B.H. Roberts Society, which sponsored this event. For those that came late and perhaps didn't hear the brief introduction, in the program there is a small prospectus on the interior which does talk about the society and its goals, and one of those is, as we mentioned, to provide a quarterly lecture series. Of course, like any small and new non-profit foundation, our ability to achieve these goals is dependent on the support which we get, and we would appreciate any support that is forthcoming, monetary and any other type that you have. We are interested in your ideas for topics. We have three other topics chosen for the remainder of the year, and be interested in your input on topics. Dr. Mattson mentioned that B.H. wished he could live 50 more years, and I believe after reading the book that this is true. Had he been able to live 50 more years, he would have been involved in an event which is going to start tomorrow. In fact, he would have probably considered it an ideal event. I speak of the Sunstone Theological Symposium. We have some pamphlets that describe the program in the banquet hall below. This is co-sponsored, or rather partially funded, by the Utah Endowment for the Humanities, and will be starting tomorrow at 9 in the morning at the University of Utah, Orson Spencer Hall. The reason B.H. might have found it ideal is because it involves a dialogue between the Mormon and non-Mormon community concerning major theological topics. There will be 30 prominent Mormon scholars presenting papers all day Friday, all day Saturday, and there are some events at night too. In addition, there will be 5 non-LDS Mormon scholars, non-Mormons who are Mormon scholars, or scholars on Mormonism. They will be coming from various parts of the country to share their perspectives on our theology. And Saturday evening, there will be a panel of local ministers and pastors who will meet in a dinner setting at the Hotel Utah, and they will discuss their feelings, their impressions of Mormon theology. So I think we'll have a very excellent feast in these few days, and we invite those of you that enjoy evenings such as this to participate in that as well. I think that concludes the announcements, and again, we express our appreciation. I, for one, would like to again extend thanks in the form of clapping to our speakers for their participation.